From NPR News and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The president doubled down on his attacks of four Democratic congresswomen of color at his rally last night, questioning their love of country.
They're always telling us how to run it, how to do this, how to do that. You know what? If they don't love it, tell them to leave it.
And later, when he spoke of Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, the only one of the four born outside the U.S. in Somalia, he called her anti-Semitic. She has questioned the power of Israel. And this happened.
Send her back.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us. Ron, this week, most Republican lawmakers refused to criticize the president's tweets earlier this week, saying that these women, all U.S. citizens, should go back to the country they came from. And again, three were born here. But what's been the reaction to his supporters taking that up last night?
Discomfort, Robin. I think that even among some of the president's strongest supporters in the Senate and in the House, there is discomfort with that chant and with the notion, which is widespread, that we're going to hear that exact chant at every Donald Trump rally for the rest of this term of his presidency. He is going to bring up this subject, and people are going to pick up that chant in much the same way that people chanted, lock her up, in 2016 in reference to Hillary Clinton and the president's implication that she was a lawbreaker who needed to be arrested and jailed.
Yeah, like you're saying, the horse is out of the barn. And optics count, and this is reminiscent of, you know, brown shirts, you know, in Nazi Germany. Well, some Republicans have distanced themselves. Here's GOP Senator Lindsey Graham, looking a little, as you said, uncomfortable speaking on to CNN this morning.
All of these congressmen won their election. They're American citizens. This is their home as much as mine. And I believe their policies will change America for the worse, and that's the debate for me.
But, Ron, is that argument working? Because we've heard Republican voters say it's their policies that they should leave the country for questioning America.
The problem here is that when Lindsey Graham says that they are as much American as he, that they have as much of a right to be here as he does, that view is clearly not shared by many of the people who were at that rally last night in North Carolina or many of the other people you can find on Twitter and other social media responding to the criticism of the president for saying these things about duly elected United States congresspersons who are citizens of the United States, three of the four of them born here. These are things that have been not just beyond the pale, but in some people's view, unlawful for the president to say. Well, it's disturbing because he is literally mischaracterizing these people as being something other than what they are. Now, of course, we have a huge debate going on many levels as to whether or not the president can be held accountable for things that he does that are outside the pale, that are outside the general legal statement of what you can say about other people, even in your official position. But of course, this is just one more example of how by disrupting all of the normal standards, disrupting the way Washington has worked, the sort of comedy between the parties, and by comedy here I mean C-O-M-I-T-Y, that old word that people would use for the uneasy relationship but nonetheless courteous relationship between political adversaries that we've had back to the very beginning of the Republic.
Okay. Well, we'll be hearing about this over the course of the day. But meanwhile, in the House, Republicans and Democrats teamed up to strike down a key Affordable Care Act tax. What was it? What does it mean?
This is a tax that was going to kick in 2022, so it's not an existing tax. Nobody's going to get a tax break that they've been enjoying. This is a tax that had been imposed as part of Obamacare as a cost control measure. Not everything in Obamacare was about cost control. Much of it was about providing insurance to people who don't have it and making it possible for people who can't afford insurance to get it. But at the other end of the income scale, where, for example, a full family policy might cost people $30,000 a year, paid for by their employer or paid for through their union contract or paid for by themselves, but the really high-end cover everything, very few copays kind of insurance, which was referred to because it's so fancy as a Cadillac plan. Now, of course, this doesn't have actually anything to do with cars. But this was going to kick in 2022, and it was meant to suppress the cost growth in healthcare. And we haven't seen whether or not it would do that because it hasn't kicked in. It's been delayed several times. Now, apparently, it's not going to happen at all because following up on this House vote, there seems to be a working majority in the Senate to pass it there. And we can assume, more or less, that President Trump would be willing to sign anything that did anything to change Obamacare.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Republicans and Democrats also joined to table an impeachment effort, but at least 100 lawmakers said they want to consider it further. So that maybe hasn't completely gone away. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Racially charged police shootings and allegations of abusive force get a lot of media attention. But there's a less well-known crisis in American policing today. Many departments across the country simply can't find enough men and women to fill their ranks. 66% of departments nationwide have reported a drop in applications. In Alaska, the problem is particularly bad. According to a new report out today from the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica, one in three communities in Alaska has no local police protection of any kind. Some departments are having to hire people with criminal records, including sex offenders. Kyle Hopkins from the Anchorage Daily News is one of the lead reporters on this story, and he joins us from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage. Kyle, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much.
Kyle, you found that many villages have no police protection. Almost all are Alaska Native communities. Has the state always struggled with this issue, or has it gotten worse in recent years?
We believe it's as bad as it's ever been. One of the things we found is that no one really was keeping track of how many communities in Alaska had police and who those police officers were. And so one thing we've tried to do with this reporting is for the first time really provide a snapshot of, okay, you know, in these small Alaska towns, these small Alaska communities, how many of them have some type of law enforcement? And we found that there's at least 70 places that have a school, that have a post office, but have no local police of any kind. And then what this latest story explores is the idea that in some places that do have police, it's because, you know, city leaders face this choice of, you know, either we have no one or we hire somebody who really anywhere else in the United States probably would not be working as a police officer.
Yeah, some of the officials you talked to spoke of, you know, a lack of jail space, a lack of housing, also burnout and low pay and constant turnover. These big problems, they're now having to resort to hiring folks with criminal records.
Right. We visited the village of Stebbins, which is on the Bering Strait. It's a place, you know, where about 600, 700 people live. It would have no police if it weren't for this small police force of guys who, what we found, all have domestic violence convictions. In a couple of cases, there were recent police officers with convictions for sexual assault. There was a registered sex offender who worked as a police officer in that community for the first 3 months of the year. And these are officers who, in some cases, are doing the same types of things that you would have a police officer doing in a major city. You know, they're arresting drunken drivers. They're putting people in jail. They're, you know, they have authority and the ability to take people into custody. And what the cities tell us is no one else is applying, because for all those reasons you mentioned that police departments are struggling with recruitment, you have that happening in rural Alaska. But then you also have this element of, you know, this is a place with no running water, no flush toilets. It can only be reached by a boat or a plane. And you're asking people to arrest, you know, their friends and family and neighbors. And so it's a pretty undesirable job.
It also seems like your reporting highlights, you know, what you guys call a two-tiered criminal justice system that may leave many Alaska Natives simply unprotected.
Well, I would say that was one of the foundational elements to the stories that we're working on this year is, you know, we're looking at Alaska's high rate of sex crimes, sex offenses, you know, which is a problem that has persisted, you know, throughout my lifetime in Alaska, and it seems to continue to get worse. You know, everything we try doesn't seem to work. And so we want to explore why that is. You know, are people in remote Alaska communities receiving a different level of public safety and justice or justice at all compared to those of us who live in the cities?
Kyle, this doesn't seem to be just a budget issue. Alaska is one of the richest states in the country. It has a $65 billion savings account thanks to oil royalties, and because of mineral royalties, residents get a personal payout each year, sometimes in the thousands. Why doesn't the state use some of this wealth to better fund public services, including law enforcement?
Oh, man, that's the subject of kind of like a civil war that's happening in Alaska right now, where there's a real fight over what the size of state spending should be, and whether or not you know, the money that we spend on services like public safety, but all services should be reduced in order to provide these oil wealth checks that we all get as Alaska residents. And, you know, that it's a fight between our governor and the legislature. And what I've heard from some regional leaders, from some Alaska Native leaders, is that they would like to see, you know, less tax credits for oil companies and more spending on the areas of Alaska where those natural resources come from, which are the remote and rural areas.
Kyle Hopkins is a reporter at the Anchorage Daily News who contributed to the new Daily News and ProPublica report on Alaska's law enforcement crisis. Kyle, great reporting. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
That's Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, just one of the many hits from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. As a member of that band, as well as the Byrds, David Crosby became an integral part of the American soundtrack, influencing a generation of rockers and singer-songwriters. But after several giant albums, world tours, and broad success, both bands dissolved in acrimony. David Crosby lost years of music to a heroin and cocaine addiction, as well as a prison sentence on drug and gun charges. Now in a new documentary, David Crosby, Remember My Name, the 77-year-old takes an unflinching look back at his life. Crosby's interviewed by filmmaker and rock journalist Cameron Crowe. Crowe and David Crosby came by the NPR studios in New York to talk with me about the movie.
I think whatever it says, I think it's a very honest film. That's the one thing they asked of me, man. They didn't ask much of me. They did ask that I, you know, I give it an honest shot. Cameron's known me since he was 15. He knows where all the bodies are buried.
Cameron, you were a teenager, as David says, when you first met them and when Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young first hit the stage and the airwaves. Talk about the impact their music had on you.
Just as a young guy, I couldn't believe that so much was being accomplished with a minimum of guitars and a maximum of these great songs. Mm. And they were all sung with such passion. It wasn't kind of disconnected pop music made to just be on the radio and that's it. These guys were really feeling it. And as a young guy, I was looking to that. So when I started doing interviews, David was one of the first guys I wanted to talk to. And to my remarkable surprise, he was the most generous interview you could have imagined for a 15-year-old fan/journalist to ever get. And I actually have never stopped interviewing David. And this film was a chance to do one more tough round of interviews. And because he was there and the camera was going and it was a very personal experience, I did feel like I could ask him anything.
He asked me the hardest question I've ever been asked in my life. And the result, you know, we went into it thinking about it the same way. Cameron doesn't want to do a shine job. I don't want to do a shine job. We knew that I have had a checkered history, and we knew that I am not a perfect person. And we're okay with that.
In the film, you go back to some of the places in Los Angeles and elsewhere where Crosby, Stills, and Nash first got going. Let's take a listen.
That's the house our house was written about, right there.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard.
Life see that interior light there, the yellowy white one, back through that window? That's the kitchen. That's where Crosby, Stills, and Nash was born, right under that light.
Did you guys know right away that you had the makings of a band that would be as huge as CSN and CSNY became?
Crosby, Stills, and Nash, we knew right away. As soon as we sang one of Stephen's songs, you know, he's a great songwriter. As soon as Nash put in the top part, we said, oh, yeah, okay, that's what I'll be doing for a while. Neil, much less sure about Neil. Neil had been in the Springfield with Stephen, and so I think he had mixed feelings. But we all knew he was a talent. The real meat of the matter in Crosby, Stills, and Nash wasn't what everybody thought it was. Yes, we had a great sound, a great vocal blend, but the real meat was in the songs. It was the juxtaposition of my songs with Nash's songs, with Stills's hit songs, and Neil. When we were trying to decide, this is in the film. I said this in the film. It's absolutely true. Neil sang me some of those songs. And when I listened to the songs that he was writing, oh, hell yes, I want him in the band.
Do you have a favorite Neil Young song?
Maybe Helpless.
Helpless, helpless, helpless.
It's a great film, but you voice a lot of regrets in it. I mean, regrets about burned bridges, about time wasted, being wasted, regrets about becoming addicted to heroin and cocaine. I mean, you're very honest in the film about those dark times. Is the film for you something of an apology or an attempt to make amends or not?
I don't think apology or making amends. It's more like a catharsis. Mm-hmm. It's more like if you want to learn from your life, okay, you have to look at things you're proud of. That you naturally do that. But you also have to look at the places where you made mistakes. You can't flinch. You can't candy coat it. Hmm. So I had to.
You say in the film at one point, I hurt a lot of people.
I did. I've hurt a lot of people. I've helped a lot more. Mm-hmm. I just have to be able to look at it and understand it and learn from it. I'm not beating myself up about any of it. Mm-hmm. Please don't get that impression. I'm not. Truthfully, I'm actually pretty happy with the guy I am now. I'm trying real hard to be a decent human being, and I like it.
I have to mention this because your struggle with drug addiction is a theme of the film. I lost a friend to heroin on July 3rd. He'd been in rehab twice and had been sober for many years, but relapsed and overdosed. And while I'm sad about it, I'm also kind of pissed off, and I know that's not really rational because addiction is a disease, but the anger is real and it's there, and kind of want to slap him and say, what the hell were you thinking?
Yeah, I know. I know that feeling.
And I'm wondering, what was the slap in the face for you that turned you around from heroin that got you sober?
There's a certain moment that you have when you know you just simply can't go on. Then you do whatever you're going to do. Some people go to prison. It worked. Going to prison worked. I don't recommend it. It's a hard, hard, hard way to kick because they don't give you an aspirin. They couldn't care less. They laughed at me and thought I was funny. Hey, rock star, how are you now?
Right.
Funny.
Cameron Crowe, what do you take away from your conversations with Crosby in making this film?
Confusion.
It was actually like a beautiful non-studio kind of experience. It was very homemade, the way we did the film, and that was really inspiring to me, but also just being able to be around Cross for an extended period of time, just being around him, I see really how to maintain nobility against many odds.
What do you see as his greatest musical legacy?
I love this song, Glory, from his last album. I love that. But he knows me well enough to know that I'm a freak for If I Could Only Remember My Name, his first solo album. And then, of course, when you're making the film, we went back through the Bird stuff, which that stuff just holds up like crazy.
It does, doesn't it?
Crazy.
It still sounds pretty good.
8 miles high, and when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known.
I like the scene when it goes to animation. You're kicked out of the Birds and you say, but I'm taking Guinevere and my weird tunings with me.
Yeah, that was true.
But then when we actually had to go to Roger McGuinn and Chris Hillman and get them to do their animation lines,
right?
They went from being horrified to be like, yeah, this is how those Lion King people do it. This is good. let's fire David again.
David, for me, one of the most poignant moments in the film is when you talk about what's happened to some of your musical friendships and relationships. Let's take a listen.
All the main guys that I made music with won't even talk to me. All of them. All. One of them hating my guts could be an accident. McGuinn, Nash,
Neil, and Stephen all really dislike me.
Do you think or hope that your openness in this film might provide some kind of path towards reconciliation with some of these people?
Oh, dimly in the background, maybe some. I don't really, it's not why we did it.
Understood.
You have to understand, I don't really think those guys are going to watch this movie. I hope that they do see it because I hope that they can see who I am now. The four of us, you know, were horrible to each other many, many times. It was a fully competitive band, and we were competing all the time. In spite of that, we made some incredible music, which I'm very proud of. And I really got to understand, I don't have any bad feelings in my heart about any of those guys. But I really can't stand around waiting to have a therapy session. I got to be making music now while I got, in the 5 minutes I got to play a song.
I do have to ask, what do you think ultimately undid the early camaraderie, friendship, and musical magic of CSNY?
I think the same thing that undid it in the Byrds. I think what happens with bands is you're in love with each other when you start. You think you're really terrific, and wow, oh, look what happens when we do this together. 40 years later, when it's devolved to turn on the smoke machine and play your hits, the joy's not there, man. If I had stayed with it, I would be still be making lots of money, but I wouldn't like music anymore.
At the end of the film, we hear you making music with a whole new band of musicians. That seems like what's keeping you going today.
It is. That's so... That puts gas in my tank, I gotta tell you. I love the process of creating songs and singing them and recording them and playing them live. I love it. I love it. I love it. I eat it for lunch. I rub it in my hair.
The new documentary is David Crosby, Remember My Name. Cameron Crowe interviews Crosby for the film and also helped produce and make it. Cameron Crowe, thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
And David Crosby, thank you for speaking with us and for all the music over all the years.
I have to thank you and NPR for being my companion on many a ride.
An inconspicuous monument in Washington, D.C. marks one of the country's most pivotal road trips, a cross-country army convoy that began 100 years ago this month and helped inspire a transformational infrastructure investment. Jordan Pascal from member station WAMU has the backstory to the Zero Milestone.
Busloads of tourists mill about in shorts and t-shirts just south of the White House. They wait to take photos near the Zero Milestone.
What did you guys come over here to see today?
The White House.
Not the Zero Milestone.
No.
Do you know about the Zero Milestone?
No.
We didn't come to see that.
Never knew it was here.
Visitors set water bottles and umbrellas on the 4-foot-tall granite monument. They lean on it when they're tired. The Zero Milestone doesn't get a lot of respect.
This is one of the most significant monuments in D.C., and yet no one's really seen it.
That's Doug Hecox of the Federal Highway Administration and a self-proclaimed history nerd.
This historical event that this particular monument commemorates gave us modern America. It was the thing that sort of set the 20th century in motion.
It was here on the Ellipse 100 years ago on July 7th, 1919, when officials unveiled the Zero Milestone to commemorate the start of a journey. A group of nearly 300 soldiers and 80 trucks embarked on the Army's first motorized cross-country convoy. Motorized vehicles played a huge role in World War I, which ended less than a year before.
The Army needed to know how long would it take or how hard would it be to move troops and equipment from the East Coast to the West Coast should we ever be invaded. No one really knew.
The 3,200-mile trek to San Francisco was a test of endurance. Most of Middle America only had dirt roads.
The 62-day drive was awful in every way, shape, or form.
Rickety wood frames, no shock absorbers, and solid rubber tires meant a bumpy journey. Breakdowns were frequent, and when it rained, roads turned to mud. It could take days to get unstuck. But when the convoy rolled through towns, it was warmly welcomed by more than 3 million Americans.
It was a little bit like watching probably an armada of UFOs fly into town. It was something most people simply had never seen.
And on that trip was a young lieutenant colonel, Dwight D. Eisenhower. The future president saw firsthand how poor the roads were. In his formal report to the government, he had strong words about the need for better investment. Peter Davies, author of American Road, talked about it on C-SPAN in 2002.
It would be very simplistic to say that because he went across the continent in 1919, in 1956 he starts saying, let's have interstates.
Seeing the Autobahn in Germany in World War II was probably more of an inspiration for the interstate. But Eisenhower's experience on the convoy had lasting impact.
He never forgot it.
Here's President Eisenhower pitching the interstate system in Detroit in 1954.
We are pushing ahead with a great road program that will take this nation out of its antiquated shackles of secondary roads all over this country and give us the types of highways that we need for this great mass of automobiles.
Remember that phrase, all roads lead to Rome? The Zero Milestone was meant to be the epicenter of American roads back in 1919, the point to which all roads are measured, just like the Golden Milestone in the Roman Empire. But that idea didn't last long. Here's Doug Hecox again.
About a month later, Tennessee decided to do the same thing. And so the entire premise behind this Zero Milestone and its intention absolutely fizzled.
But the little monument still marks the beginning of a changing country, even if tourists ignore it today. For Here and Now, I'm Jordan Pascal.
The juxtaposition of two stories this week caught our attention. Today, a federal judge in New York denied bail to wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein, accused this month of sexually abusing and trafficking dozens of underage girls in New York and Florida. But more than a decade ago, Epstein avoided similar trafficking charges in a controversial plea agreement brokered by Alex Acosta, then Florida's attorney, now the former labor secretary. Acosta's deal allowed Epstein to plead guilty to lesser charges of solicitation of prostitution, even though the young women he lured to his home were not prostitutes, go to a cushy wing of a jail, nights only, out during the day, and register as a sex offender.
And the other story. On Tuesday, Attorney General William Barr announced the Justice Department would not bring federal civil rights charges against the New York police officer who used a chokehold to forcibly subdue Eric Garner in 2014. Let's take a listen to that arrest.
Put your hand behind you.
Garner's last words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry against police brutality. So no federal charges, but now Garner's family is calling on the officer, Daniel Pantaleo, to be fired. We wanted to take a step back now and ask what these two stories say about race, privilege, and the state of the criminal justice system in America today.
And to do that, we're joined now by Paul Butler, a professor of law at Georgetown University, and formerly he served as federal prosecutor. Paul, professor, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's so disturbing to hear that tape again. But two very different cases. But what were you thinking as these two headlines converged?
So the only person connected to the Eric Garner case who's gone to jail is Ramsey Orta. He's the man who used his cell phone to make the video of Garner's homicide, the video that we just heard. What I think the Epstein story is about is equal protection of law and the failure of poor people and minorities to receive that equal protection. Too often when there's been violence against a person of color, especially by a police officer, those cases don't receive the same kinds of resources as when other people want the police and prosecutors to step in. You know, there's this famous song by Public Enemy that says 911 is a joke. In the experience of minorities, law enforcement is very focused on locking them up, but not as interested when people of color seek to have police officers brought to justice.
Well, I'm going to say, and this we'll maybe get to later in our conversation, but you know, there are police in the Epstein case in Miami who wanted to do more, but they were, you know, pushed out of the picture by officials higher up. We'll get to that. But in Eric Garner's case, NYPD internal affairs investigators determined that Pantaleo had used a chokehold, which is not legal. They recommended disciplinary charges, which never materialized. There's also an ongoing NYPD disciplinary trial. Earlier this year, a doctor testified that the chokehold triggered an asthma attack that killed Garner. But we just heard William Barr say no federal charges, overruling his own civil rights division prosecutors. They wanted an indictment, but Barr sided with New York prosecutors who didn't. You were once a federal prosecutor at DOJ. Your sense of that?
So the federal prosecutor in Brooklyn said that he didn't think that in a trial they could prove willfulness, the idea that Officer Pantaleo knowingly broke the law. But the experienced trial attorneys in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department said that they could prosecute and win the case. And I think that that's right. In 1998, the Department of Justice won a case against an NYPD officer for killing a man by putting him in a chokehold. And in the Garner case, they had that videotape that the whole world has seen of Mr. Garner getting knocked to the ground, Officer Pantaleo putting his hands on Garner's neck and choking him to death.
His elbow, all
over a misdemeanor arrest because Garner allegedly was selling a tobacco cigarette.
That aren't getting taxed.
Yeah,
that's the petty crime. Yeah.
Paul Butler, I mean, compare that a little deeper to the Epstein case. I mean, it's hard not to see that in both cases, you know, a white defendant and a white police officer were given favorable treatment over, you know, vulnerable, low-income young girls, many of color, and a black man selling loose cigarettes. To many, doesn't this just reinforce that there are fundamental issues in our criminal justice system that are just broken?
So if the Garner case is about equal protection of law, Epstein is about equal justice under the law. Epstein got a whole lot of breaks that low-income people don't get. For example, he was allowed to be placed on work release. Mm. And if we think about how this works, again, his deal is that for 12 hours a day, he gets to go to this office and work. Well, in fact, the office was for a foundation that was created by Mr. Epstein right before he started serving his time. After he served his time, the foundation went out of business. So it seemed like it was created just to give him a nice place to go for 12 hours a day. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, is this racist? Is it classist? It's not as simple as that. Hmm. So in Florida, they told Mr. Epstein, okay, we might go along with this, but you have to have a security officer from our office with you every time you step out of this jail cell. Mr. Epstein, the billionaire, said no problem. He paid $128,000 in order to have this security officer accompany him. And obviously that's not something that the 80% of people who are locked up, who before they were locked up, live below the poverty line. That's not something that those guys and women could afford.
Right. Or we get to, I mean, as we said in Eric Garner's case, he didn't even get beyond the street corner with the police. But what do you think it says that now, the charges, the trafficking charges against Epstein now are from the same period, 2002 to 5, I believe. Same young women. Some others are, you know, joining their new lawsuits and everything. And now Epstein had offered to live in his mansion, which is apparently the most expensive in Manhattan, and hire private security, offered the same things. He didn't apparently get that today. He didn't get bail. Has there been a change, at least on the end of the wealthy having power in the system?
This is a very high-profile case. The judge understands that. When we look at the actual data, I'm not sure it's fair to say that there's been a shift in how rich people get treated. And to be fair, many of the considerations that Epstein received are appropriate for many defendants. So in the Florida case, the prosecutors didn't throw the book at him, even though they could have. They offered him work release. He didn't have to serve his full sentence. And all of those we know are helpful at making someone return to the society, come home from prison with more resources to do well. The problem isn't that Mr. Epstein got some breaks. The problem is that he got those breaks probably because he's a rich white man who could afford them. And if other defendants were to receive that same quality of services, well, we'd all be safer.
Because they'd be, as you said, they'd have a better chance of being reintegrated into society. Yeah,
exactly.
Paul,
at the end of... I'm sorry.
Well, in the last minute we have, I want to look at solutions a little bit. I mean, there are some progressive district attorneys in cities that are trying to make some bold changes in the criminal justice system, on sentencing, on reducing sort of the tyranny of plea bargains. Where do you see the most effective reform happening, city and state or the federal level, when looking at the big issues, big fundamental issues?
Well, we know that the reform isn't going to come from the federal government for civil rights cases like the department might have brought in the case of Mr. Garner, under Attorney General Barr, the civil rights cases brought by the Justice Department are 60% down from the Obama administration and 50% down from the George W. Bush administration. But the fact is that 90% of criminal cases are state cases, and there's lots of reforms going on in the states to reduce incarceration, mandatory minimum sentences. The war on drugs is incredibly racially selective. Black folks don't use drugs more than anybody else, but they get locked up way more than other folks. And, you know, with Mr. Epstein, he had some of the best attorneys in the country. He had Ken Starr. He had Alan Dershowitz. If low-income people could get quality defense, that would make a huge difference in bringing us equal justice under the law.
Paul Butler, professor at Georgetown Law and a former federal prosecutor. As we can't help but notice, two headlines. No federal charges for the white police officer accused of chokehold killing Eric Garner. But then again, no bail for Jeffrey Epstein. Paul Butler, thanks so much for taking a look at it with us.
Thank you for having me.
A recent ESPN report highlighted a growing number of injuries in the NBA, and the story by ESPN senior reporter Baxter Holmes said there might be a link between these injuries and youth basketball leagues. Many players who eventually make it to the NBA take part in those youth leagues. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So this ESPN story introduces us to a guy named Tim DeFrancesco, the strength and conditioning coach for the LA Lakers. And he thinks these young players coming into the NBA, in his words, are ticking time bombs from an injury perspective. Mike, tell us what he's talking about.
Well, a lot of these players come in at 19 years old, at 20 years old, but the amount of mileage they have on them and the amount of high impact plyometric jumping and intense 360 dunks is equivalent to what a pretty grown adult of 10 or 20 years ago would have on them. Players at a young age are asked to specialize. And the evidence and the academic research into this is growing more and more unequivocal, which is that early specialization is really bad in a number of ways. David Epstein has a whole new book about this, and he kind of looks at the idea of Tiger Woods versus Roger Federer. And Tiger was this golf prodigy who only golfed, and Roger Federer was obviously he's a great tennis player, but he played all sorts of sports. And Epstein conclusively shows that the sampling period, the greater diversity of the amount of sports you play, has a number of beneficial effects in terms of just being good in sports and being mentally into the sports, but especially on the wear and tear on young bodies. And the NBA is really beginning to see this.
Well, Ed, but Mike, hasn't this been going on, or is there something new? Are players, you know, maybe skipping college and maybe that's bringing them younger into the NBA? I mean, is there something else going on now?
Yes. I mean, it is more exacerbated than it's been in the past. So last year, the league total minutes missed were 5,000 minutes. The year before that, the NBA number of games, not minutes, games lost to injury or illness was also 5,000 minutes, and it never surpassed 5,000 before. So we're really seeing an unprecedented number of games lost. And the reason seems to be, among other reasons, that they're playing so much more basketball. It's not just that when young players come into the league, there's no off season for a lot of these guys. They play and train really hard. I think it has something to do with the fact that the salaries are just so huge. And so the incentive is there to get into the gym, lose some weight, work on a shot. But it's just basketball, basketball, basketball. And unlike, you know, Kareem and Magic Johnson, who had real off seasons, unlike Michael Jordan, who golfed during the off season and didn't play that much basketball, these guys have so many miles on their bodies, so many minutes that are recorded in the record books, but also what they're doing in the off season. And the proof is there. It's just showing up in terms of injuries. Think about the NBA Finals game 5. Kevin Durant goes out due to injury. He'll be lost next season. Right. Game 6, the Warriors, Klay Thompson goes down due to injury. He'll be lost next season. And all the big signings this offseason, huge injury concerns with everyone, right? Mm-hmm. Durant for the Nets. You even have Kawhi Leonard going to the Clippers, but he missed 20 games mm-hmm. due to injuries and almost all of the season before. LeBron James, he missed 20-something games due to injury for the first time. There's so many injuries in the NBA.
Yeah. Well, Mike, how concerned is the league about this, and what are they doing about it?
Adam Silver is concerned, and what he's trying to do is introduce some guidelines, and I suppose just he's worked with USA Basketball a set number of minutes for 7-year-olds to 10-year-olds, and then for high school kids, they say don't practice more than 3 to 4 days a week. On the lower levels, though, the AAU, which is the catch-all phrase for the youth leagues, they chafe a little bit. Oh, it's really nice for the NBA to give us some advice because, you know, they want good, healthy players, but the reality of what we have to do is the parents really want to channel the kids into basketball. The kids are intent about playing basketball. It's so hard to get a scholarship. The stakes are so high. There are a lot of societal pressures to specialize, even though that might, and in fact, it's increasingly shown to be a maladaptive behavior.
Can I ask a really stupid question?
No, there are no such things.
What's plyometrics?
Oh, it's the jumping, volleyball, basketball. Oh.
How did you say jumping?
Yeah, but jumping.
Okay, so here's the second part of the stupid question. Is it possibly, and we only have about a minute here, but is it possibly the sneakers or the courts? I mean, you'd think those things were advanced and it would mean less injuries, or fewer injuries, but is that a stupid question.
Basketball, actually, I once did a report on a shoe that was supposed to, a sneaker that was supposed to decrease ankle injuries, and in fact it did, but it increased knee injuries.
There you go.
I mean, yeah, the human body is such that there's going to be stress up the line.
Mike Pesca.
I don't think it's the courts. I think it's the amount of time spent on the courts.
Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst, host of the daily podcast The Gist, Slate.com. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR News and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.